This submitted white paper proposes a comprehensive operational architecture to complete John McMurtry's Life Value Ontoaxiology program, translating its philosophical compass into falsifiable interdisciplinary frameworks for governance and inquiry.
Yeah. And I just have to say right at the start, the philosophical robustness of this material is just, it's incredibly impressive. I mean, successfully bridging that kind of abstract axiology with actual empirical utility is really hard to pull off.
Right. It's a huge undertaking. But to jump right in, integrating the three-tiered epistemic framework into the initial operational grammar will significantly strengthen the causal sequence's practical application.
Absolutely. Because, you know, you have this brilliant three-tiered epistemic framework in the text, the mutually correcting standpoints of first person, second person, and third person evidence.
Which is such a vital concept for this.
Concepts. They don't even make an appearance until section 10.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is really late in the game.
Right? By the time the reader actually gets there, we've already waded through all these dense dynamic process models and the anti-displacement tests established way back in section 6.
So they've done all that heavy lifting without the context.
Exactly. Because the epistemology appears so late, those earlier operational frameworks end up just kind of floating in a vacuum. I mean, they feel totally detached from how they will actually be measured and experienced by real human beings in practice.
Okay, but I have to stop you there, though. Is moving epistemology forward akin to explaining the mechanics of a telescope before the reader even understands we're looking at stars?
That's an interesting way to frame it.
Well, you know, because the paper is so heavily rooted in ontology, the nature of being, doesn't bringing in the mechanics of measurement this early kind of clutter the ontological groundwork that McMurtry's entire philosophy relies on?
See, if this were standard classical mechanics, sure. You would absolutely want to separate the instrument from the object being observed, right?
Right. Keep them totally distinct.
Yeah. But in life value systems, the lens and the life it observes are fundamentally inseparable. Like the ontology of living coherence is inherently relational.
Ah, okay. I see where you're going.
Right. So a living unity's felt valence, which, you know, it's just the technical way of saying the raw internal experience of suffering or thriving, that isn't just a byproduct of a system.
It's the system answering back.
Exactly. It is the system answering back. So introducing those three standpoints early doesn't clutter the ontology at all. It actually proves it. It demonstrates to the reader that life value ontoaxiology refuses to rely on this detached, purely third-person view from nowhere.
Okay, yeah. So the suggestion here is to restructure the flow to introduce or at least heavily mirror the epistemic triad much earlier. Like embed it directly into the need satisfier capacity viability model in section 6.
Yes, because the reader has to understand the exact mechanisms of observation driving those flow and assimilation stages.
Right, so we need to visualize what that actually looks like on the page. Like when explaining the need satisfier capacity causal sequence, especially in figure 2, they should explicitly tag which epistemic standpoint measures each node.
Yeah. That would make a huge difference.
It's basically like putting a dashboard gauge directly onto each part of the engine diagram.
Precisely. Let's break down the how of that, you know? You would annotate the diagram to note that measuring felt valence relies entirely on first-person reporting. I mean, only the individual can actually tell you if they're hurting.
Right. You can't observe that from the outside.
Exactly. Then you move to the next node and show that measuring access and assimilation requires second-person dialogic care.
Meaning it requires a relationship.
Right. Someone actually recognizing and responding to that need. And then finally, you clarify that evaluating the overall provision flow of resources relies on that third-person empirical observation.
That makes so much sense. By mapping the epistemology directly onto the causal sequence, the abstract model suddenly stops being just a theory and becomes this fully instrumented dashboard. The reader instantly grasps how the data is gathered.
Which is exactly what policymakers need to see.
Right. But okay, so we have this dashboard. We have real, felt data. But data doesn't survive in a vacuum. If you hand this framework over to institutional directors, they are immediately going to demand to see the math.
Oh, they always do.
Right. How does the author translate felt valence into something a bureaucrat can calculate? That brings us to section 6.3. and grounding the mathematical scaffolding with a continuous high-stakes narrative example will prevent audience alienation and clarify the framework's real-world urgency.
Yeah, the draft really stumbles hard here, to be honest. There is this sudden, almost abrupt introduction of formal equations.
Just out of nowhere.
Literally, we're reading along, absorbing all this beautiful life-ground philosophy, and then bam, we hit a brick wall of algebra. We get the derivative of capacity over time and the margin equation where m equals c minus l.
Which is tough for a general audience.
Well, yeah. For a heavily interdisciplinary readership, which is who they are targeting, presenting formal abstraction without an immediate parallel demonstration of its explanatory power in a real-world scenario is a massive weakness.
You're just going to lose the clinicians, the educators, you know, the exact people who most need to understand this architecture.
Exactly. The material makes a strong case for formalizing these dynamics, but it desperately needs a recognizable anchor.
So the suggestion is to pair those formal equations directly with a running specific domain application. I mean, I noticed they draw from clinical and public health examples much later in the text.
Right. Way too late.
Yeah. They need to pull those examples right up into section 6.3. Anchor the mathematics in human terms immediately.
Let's run through exactly how they could do that. Just using the margin equation, where margin equals capacity minus load.
Okay, yeah. Walk me through it.
Instead of leaving it as abstract variables, drop an emergency room nurse into that equation. Show us an actual 12-hour shift.
Oh, I like that.
You demonstrate exactly how the nurse's biological and institutional capacity, so that's the C variable, operates against a crushing patient load, which is the L variable.
So in hour one, C is high. The nurse is rested, the hospital is fully stocked, the load, L, is manageable. Therefore, the margin M is positive.
Right. But then by hour 10, the biological capacity is draining, institutional supplies are bottlenecked, and, I don't know, a multi-car pileup just pushed the patient load through the roof.
The L variable spikes.
Exactly. You track that single nurse through the equations to show how L completely overtakes C, resulting in a negative margin.
Wow. Yeah, that makes it very real.
Right, because it proves to the reader why a positive regenerative margin is a universal biological necessity. It's not just some unused economic capital sitting on a ledger. You can explain how continuous negative margin leads to allostatic load, which is essentially the biological wear and tear that causes a complete system breakdown in a human body.
I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this, though. Because by turning human vitality into an algebraic variable like C, aren't we walking right into a trap?
How do you mean?
Well, the central thesis of this paper is that modern ruling systems are blinded by their own metrics. They reduce everything to a spreadsheet. Does mapping life value to algebraic variables risk repeating the exact category error of modern institutions? Like stripping the qualitative felt essence from the metric and replacing it with a letter?
It totally looks like a trap on the surface. I mean, that is the fundamental danger of what McMurtry calls the money sequence inversion, where the metric just becomes more important than the life it's supposed to measure.
Exactly. That's my worry.
But, okay, look at this from the perspective of systemic defense. The mathematics here aren't being used to reduce the human being. They are being used to bound the institution.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, if we don't give policymakers a formal scaffold to calculate the depletion of life capital, they will simply default to the metrics they already have. They will measure that ER nurse's shift purely by throughput, efficiency, and profit.
Oh, I see. They will look at hour 10, see a massive spike in treated patients, and call it a highly productive, successful shift.
Completely ignoring the fact that the nurse is biologically collapsing in the hallway.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. Exactly why the math is necessary.
It is a tool for protection, but provided, and this is the crucial mechanical link back to our first critique, provided it is constantly corrected by the first-person felt evidence we discussed earlier.
Yes. The nurse's lived exhaustion has to feed back into the variable C. The math only works if it is tethered to the epistemology, if the author visually links the ER nurse's first-person reporting directly to the variable C on the page, the reader will immediately understand that this isn't standard economic algebra. This is a life-protective calculus.
Right. So we have the mathematical framework and we have the lived experience anchoring it. But, and there's always a but.
The second you formalize a metric, the system will try to consume it. Expanding the analysis of institutional capture will fortify the paper's defenses against the very metric-driven systems it seeks to reform.
Yeah, and the framework outlines institutional capture in Section 12.5, but honestly, the weakness is that it's surprisingly brief.
Almost like a footnote. Right, it leaves a massive conceptual gap, because the premise here is that modern institutions inherently weaponize and game their own success measures. If we know bureaucratic systems are incredibly adept at gaming standardized test scores or, you know, gaming GDP to hide inequality, we have to assume they will use that exact same agility to game life value onto axiology metrics too.
Yeah, it's Goodhart's law, right? When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure.
Exactly.
But can any measurable framework, even one anchored securely in the life ground, truly resist being gamed by capital systems that excel at absorbing critique? I mean, capital is highly agile. It takes radical frameworks, hollows out their core, and just wears them as a skin to justify business as usual.
That is the big fear, which is exactly why the author needs to deepen the safeguards section. The suggestion here is to apply the LVAOA framework to predict exactly how a life knowledge commons could itself be manipulated.
So kind of anticipating the attack.
Yes, providing a proactive adversarial stress test of their own proposed architecture. They absolutely must build in that immune response.
What would that look like in the text?
Well, the author should develop a detailed case study on pseudo-satisfiers occurring within the LVOA tracking system itself.
Pseudo-satisfiers?
Yeah. A pseudo-satisfier is something that looks like it meets a need on paper, but actually depletes life value in reality.
Okay, give me a concrete example of how that mechanical friction plays out.
Sure. Think about a regional public health board trying to inflate its restorative margin scores for its staff. Under the new LVOA system, they are mandated to improve the capacity variable, C, for their nurses.
Right.
So, to hit their target, the board mandates an unpaid, compulsory wellness and resilience seminar for all staff immediately following their 12-hour shifts.
Oh, man. I can already see the dashboard lighting up with false positives.
Exactly. The staff are technically receiving a wellness intervention. This ticks a box on the hospital's third-person empirical dashboard. The bureaucrats can point to the metric and say, look, we are injecting restorative margin into the system.
But in reality, it drains the nurse's first-person felt valence.
Dramatically. It depletes their actual time to sleep, rest, and recover. The board is gaming the new LVOA metrics just as effectively as they used to game patient treatment volumes.
That is insidious. So how does the framework reconcile that contradiction? Like, how does the author prove on the page that this architecture can catch the pseudo-satisfier in real time?
By explicitly tying this scenario back to the adversarial research proposed in Section 13.4, the author needs to show the mechanics of the falsifiability. You show the researchers actively hunting for these loopholes by triangulating the data.
Ah, comparing the different epistemological standpoints?
Exactly. The third-person data says wellness provided, but the system architecture demands that the third-person data must be corroborated by the first-person data, and when the researchers look at the first-person felt valence, it shows a massive spike in exhaustion.
Right. So the contradiction triggers a systemic alarm.
Right. Expanding Section 12.5 isn't just about adding a few caveats warning that people might cheat. It is about demonstrating the mechanical immune system of the LVOA program. It proves that the framework is genuinely self-correcting.
I love that. If the paper predicts its own commodification and builds in the exact mechanisms to detect pseudo-satisfiers, it moves from being just a theoretical ideal to a hardened operational tool.
It really does. It makes the whole thing bulletproof.
Well, let's bring all of this together. We've mapped out three really significant architectural upgrades for this text. First, pull the epistemic triad of first, second, and third person evidence forward, embedding it directly into the operational grammar in Section 6 so the reader actually understands how the data is gathered.
Yeah. And second, anchor those formal mathematical equations in continuous real-world examples. Walk us through that ER nurse's shift to maintain accessibility, proving that the algebra is actually a life-protective calculus rather than just a standard economic reduction.
Right. And third, stress test the framework, expand on how LVOA metrics might be gained by institutions, detailing the system's immune response to capture through triangulating that first and third person data.
Because right now, modern institutions measure health kind of like a restaurant measuring its success purely by the speed of the dishwasher, just completely ignoring whether the food is actually edible.
That's a great way to put it. And this paper is trying to rebuild the entire menu from the ground up.
It really is. It's a massive, ambitious undertaking to bridge the life ground to living coherence. And these adjustments will ensure the operational architecture can actually bear the weight of that ambition.
Absolutely. We want to thank the listener for submitting such deeply vital, transdisciplinary work. We warmly invite you to revise the material based on this critique and submit it back for a follow-up review, taking abstract philosophy and forging it into a falsifiable, defensive shield for human vitality is no small feat. Keep building.